curious. Go ahead.
All right, well, here we go. And I'm going to try phoning this talk in. We'll see if it works. So I guess first I'd like to thank the organizers for letting me have this opportunity. And apologize to Alain if he's actually in the room, because he saw this talk about 2 weeks ago. All right. Okay, he's already gone. Well, I warned him, so you know. All right, I have a lot of collaborators in a lot of different areas. Thank you. Most of the work I'm going to be talking about today is work with Ryo Kobayashi and Laszlo Garnacsi, also Alex Lipkowski, who's actually, I think, at MIT now. Participated in some of the asymptotics, and a whole gang of other people. Plus, I have colleagues working in a variety of other areas in phase field modeling, and I, you know, just like to recognize them all. Excuse me? Why are they pink? What? That's oh well. If you figured Bettinger, McFadden, oh, why? It's also a very nice German sports sedan. okay. Plus BMW. After you leave NIST, you get a BMW. Oops, wrong way. Okay. Okay. Right. The government's getting better all the time. Okay. Okay, so pre-outline. First of all, you may have noticed this is bio-small. I'm not going to be talking about biology, although that may be a reference to my height. I think this may be the only talk on crystal growth, which is interesting given the provenance of much of the research that we're talking about today. I still think there are lots of interesting and outstanding questions in crystal growth. Two issues today that I'm going to get into are the role of heterogeneities in solidification pattern formation and spherolytic growth, or how to grow the simplest pattern of all. Okay, so here's the real outline. So I'm going to give you some reminders about the phase field method. I'd say about 50% of the people in this room don't need much of this, but the other half do, so I apologize to that half. Angle. I'm going to introduce an angle variable, which will be sort of new to the phase field method. Basic results, talk about what happens when you put foreign particles in the material, and then talk about the meaning of heterogeneity, spherolytic growth, and then I'll probably be over time, so they'll kick me off. All right, so let's just do a quick reminder, and I'll try to go through this fairly quickly, of what the phase field method is, like what are the order parameters, 1 to 2. Okay, so here's a sort of practical engineer's approach to what a diffuse interface model is, or Ginzburg-Landau, or Model A, or whatever, you know, floats your boat for a description of this model, is that if you had a free energy density, which was solely a function of something we'll call the phase field, phi, which has got minima at 0 and 1, then a system would prefer to sit in one of these two equilibrium states. This would mean that you would not want any material in the intermediate state, so you would end up with a sharp interface. If you add a penalty for gradients, then this would be prohibited because it would cost you energy. So there's a balance between these two, which gives you a diffuse interface. Okay, and you sit in some happy medium. Now, this is a sort of simplistic phenomenological way of looking at our physical motivations for this model. Obviously, this is a physics conference. But this idea is going to come back and haunt us, so I'm reinforcing it in this particular way. Okay. All right. The dynamics are fairly straightforward. You get a dynamics for the phase field, and in this case, the temperature field. Okay. So what is the phase field variable? You know, one particular view of it is that if you measure the density as you move from the solid to the liquid, you can measure correlations, which will be exactly very sharply peaked for a perfect crystalline lattice, and there'll be some die-off of those correlations as you move into the liquid. Okay, and so that envelope could be characterized as the phase field. Obviously, that's not a complete picture. What are we missing? Well, that's only one order parameter. There actually can be demonstrated to be an infinite number, and so you obviously have to make a fair number of approximations to get from infinity down to 1. All right, so physically, another way to think about the physical motivation for the phase field is to think about critical fluctuations in an undercooled material. If the undercooling is high enough, the critical fluctuation is typically between 10 and 100 molecules. And you can then actually convince yourself that you actually really do need a diffuse interface to properly understand nucleation in an undercooled melt. And Laszlo Garnacsi has done some nice theoretical work where he's computed phase fields and then essentially with no adjustable parameters, calculated what the interface phase profiles look like as a function of undercooling. So these are lower undercooling and increasing undercooling as you move that way. And you'll see that the phase field goes down to zero for this larger particle, which is a radius of around 20 angstroms. But as you get to smaller particles, the phase field doesn't make it all the way to zero, i.e. you're in a highly disordered state, a more interface-like state inside the bulk of the material, if you want to even call it bulk. Okay, and you'll get quantitative comparisons with the molecular dynamics and experiments. Anyway, this is just motivation. Okay, that's just with one order parameter, so you're doing pretty well. Sorry for excessive PowerPoint abuse. It's sometimes irresistible. Anyway, so here's a lot of the stuff that's been done. You know, we can look at growth, we can get pretty snowflake-like patterns, and these are almost a decade old now, these calculations. We can look at, you know, distribution of solute inside a solid. There's a host of people who have done work on these problems. You know, we can look at melting of these structures, we can ask how they connect up to each other and bridge. We can try to do three-dimensional calculations, although I should note that it's still hard to do three-dimensional calculations. You can do them, and it takes. Yeah.
Just an idea. How long does this take on a computer?
This was done on an SP2 with about 20 nodes. I think it ended up being about 3,000 hours of real CPU time, and that was 3 years ago. What? No. I'm talking total integrated node time was about 3,000 hours. Yeah, I don't know, you know, whatever. You know, I work with a guy named Bill George on this, and he was the one who was involved in parallelizing it. Okay, so within the context of everything that I've just shown you, we still can't do this yet in this talk, and this is some polymer growth experiments by Vince Ferrero back when he was at NIST, and you can see dendritic growth. We got lots of different ones in different orientations. We'd like to be able to do that too. Okay, we really want to be able to do polycrystals. So how do we do this? That's going to be a big piece of this, and then we're going to move on to some of the consequences. One of the particular consequences is that if I can do that previous movie, then I can also should be able to do this as part of the same story, which is after they've collided, I should be able to model grains. This kind of looks just like a coarsening foam, but in fact, it's succinylnitrile and some laser dye coarsening as a function of time, and I think they used a confocal microscopy. I don't know, Wolfgang.
This is real observation.
This is real. This is not a simulation.
And that's 2D.
It's quasi-2D. It's between some plates. Just jump all over me if I get it wrong. Anyway, so this is just suggestive of where we'd like to go. Let's go. I make that noise when I back up. Okay. All right. Let's see if the radio actually works. Okay. Let's just use the analog method. Okay. All right, so how do we do polycrystals? Okay, so the first thing we'd like to do is say, okay, I'm going to forget about that phase field variable for a minute and just pretend I'm in a completely perfect solid. What I'd like is to imagine a new parameter theta that now does that same nice thing that the phase field variable does, goes from 0 to 1 over some finite range. Okay, and there's going to be a nice smooth interface transition. Okay, so you know, you could ask, well, why did I pick theta? Why phi? I'll get a little bit into that. But for the moment, we'd just like to do this, and of course, the obvious thing to do would be just what I did before, where I created a diffuse interface model, right? Which is that I put some wells in the free energy at these thetas, and I put some counterbalancing force there, I get a nice diffuse interface, game over, and I'm done. Right? Seems like a good plan, nice, simple phenomenological approach. But as you can guess, it's not going to work. Another approach, which is essentially identical, is to have a different order parameter for each one of those orientations, and you can map this model onto that one or vice versa. It's not a good idea for grains, and this was pointed out to me by my colleague Adam Wheeler about 6 years ago. And why is that? Well, that free energy density shouldn't be a function of theta. It's not physical. That would mean if I took a single crystal in free space and rotated it, its energy would change. And that is wrong. So we'd like something that where F is independent of theta. So why theta and phi? Well, we want to form F from invariance, hopefully. Okay, in this case, theta. Okay. So, how would we construct the model? Well, we got a free energy density, so I'm going to erase theta from this. That's one way to solve the problem of taking theta out of the picture. Okay, if I do that, and I say let's consider a pure solid, so this term's gone, there's no gradients in phi, all that's left is this guy, grad theta squared, that's our old friend the XY model, simplest model of elasticity. If you do relaxational dynamics, which we tend to like to do in phase field modeling, you'll get a diffusion equation for theta, and that's wrong. So something bad has happened. Well, what's really happened? Well, what's really happened is that I've ignored topological defects, which everybody in this room knows about probably. But I don't want to model all the topological defects in the system. If I have to do that, I'm dead. There's too many dislocations in a big crystal for me to model that thing this way. So the question is, can I use this approach and still get a physical picture? Okay. How am I doing on time? I have 10 minutes? That's good. Only talk 10 minutes? Okay, felt like 20. Okay, so here's the approach I'm going to take. I'm going to look for zero energy solutions to a free energy density. If they're zero, I'm going to throw them away because they're going to be minimum energy solutions. And this is the theta profile. I don't want this theta profile, okay? Well, if I have this theta profile, I know how to do this integral where I've just taken an arbitrary power n. It's easy to convince yourself that this integral is just delta theta, this jump, divided by the length to n minus 1. If you take the limit l goes to infinity, you're going to get 0 for n greater than 1. Why? It's obvious. This thing just penalizes interfaces. So it gets rid of the interface. However, if n equals 1, you get this. Okay, this thing is a little funny from physicists' perspective. Funny enough to get you into trouble when you try to submit it to physical review letters. But let's continue on this approach. Let's take a little closer look. Let's assume theta is monotonically increasing. All right. If it is, then I can do this integral. It's path independent. All of these profiles are the same energetically. Okay, what I really like is this red profile. That'd be nice. But I could get any one of them. However, since all of them are equivalent in energy, if there was a function multiplying it which had a minimum somewhere, then what it would do is load that theta profile at the minimum. That's precisely what I want. So if I couple theta to this profile, that's precisely what I get. Okay, so this is a sort of top-down approach based on the symmetries to give you a new model. Okay, this is just our old friend, the classic solidification model, and now all I have to do is add one more term, some coupling to the phase field times this, and I'm done. Okay, you can add higher order terms, that doesn't change the argument, as long as this is the leading order term. Okay? And the beauty of this, of course, is we've only added one more equation we have to solve, and we can suddenly do polycrystals, as opposed to the Jello mold model or the multi-order parameter model, which involves an essentially infinite number in principle. So we'd like to compare this with experiment, hopefully eventually quantitatively. We want to worry about the mathematics of mag grad theta. This turns out to be a little bit tricky, and it's good to have Ryo Kobayashi, an applied mathematician, on your team when you're studying this stuff. We only have two parameters we have to solve for. It's easy to add anisotropy, just like we add it to phase field methods. Of course, there's some interesting questions. First of all, what does gradient mean in theta space that you need to think carefully about? And I'm not going to explain that today. And also, how do we extend this to 3D? The symmetries get more interesting.
It's a vector.
What's a vector?
Right. You take the magnitude of the vector.
Theta currently is 2D, so it's a scalar. Okay, in 3D, I'm going to have to think more hard, and that's something I'm doing. We got the group theory books. Gradient, yes, but it's a magnitude. Yes.
Yeah.
It is the magnitude, right. So there is this interesting, you have to worry about things like subdifferentials and things like that to properly handle the mathematics here.
What does phi do here?
That's a good question. What is the disorder at the boundary? Okay. And I've been trying to figure out for a while what the difference between the essential disordering associated with liquid-solid transition is versus the disordering associated with the grain boundary and not come up with any meaningful distinction. This is actually the big contribution of Alex Lepofsky, is that we were able to throw away an extra parameter. So I used to have two order parameters here, one for grains and one for liquid-solid. Don't need it. Can't think of a reason why. And in fact, it's even better than that. It brings some credible physics into this that we hadn't even thought about when we started doing it, which is if, in fact, the grain boundary energy, which is now a function of misorientation, gets large enough, then you get grain boundary wetting, which is precisely physical. Okay, so that comes right out of this now. It's just guaranteed you'll get a phase transition at the boundary when you would rather have two liquid interfaces than one solid-solid interface. We can also hook up the free energy to recover Reed-Shockley if we want to by appropriate choice of couplings, which is the classic one for low-angle grain boundaries. And the model guarantees motion by mean curvature, which you need to have for a model of grain boundaries. So it has all of the right physics in it that way. If we put the angle above this wetting critical angle and then warm the system up from below, the width will diverge. This is an example of how you get grain boundary wetting. If you're below a critical angle, then it reaches a finite width. Okay. And we actually looked at then fixed sizes and again varied this misorientation as a function of angle, and you can watch these spheres pushing themselves apart from each other as you increase the angle. Okay. Now this is all just set up. I'm summarizing a fairly large amount of previous work. Okay, we can then solve two-dimensional calculations, and this now, as you could see, had both growth, impingement, and then subsequent coarsening of a grain structure. Now these are isotropic. There is no interface energy anisotropy for growth. However, there is anisotropy in the energies of these boundaries because the misorientation is different for each one. And we watch this thing coarsen like a foam. You see there's dynamics now for theta and for phi. We can fiddle with this. This thing has an interesting consequence, which is that the grains can rotate. Okay, and actually if you look at nanograin systems, you actually will observe that the grains can rotate as a way of reducing the free energy of the system. And so we picked up another phenomenon for free that you couldn't get from something like a Jell-O mold model. One of the interesting effects, which currently isn't in this model, is that the grains can rotate the wrong way, i.e. towards higher misorientation, and there are physical arguments why that can happen. And I think actually I have a very nice fix for that. But that's another story as well. It is just the angle measure with respect to the x-axis, if you like. Okay. And so again, so now we can look at, now we can get my dream, which was growing dendrites, and they run into each other, and then you form a grain structure, and then they coarsen as a function of time. So again, we're solving only three equations here, temperature, phase, and angle. Lots of phenomena for three equations. Okay, and when Irina Loganova was at NIST last year, she was able to do this for the alloy case, just like I showed at the beginning, and now she's got four dendrites running into each other. She did it on a very fancy adaptive grid, and we did some numerical studies as well. And then this guy, Laszlo Granacsi, who I ran into about, I guess it was 2 years ago now at a conference, he had taken our model and done these enormous calculations. So this is just a blow up of this. This is the phase field, this is the solute field. So it's a 7,000 by 7,000 calculation. He wanted to do nucleation, so he was doing large numbers of particles. He added an extra piece of physics to the model, which I think is really nice, which is he now allows the liquid to have a fluctuating theta. How much time do I got? Oh, I got 12 minutes. No problem. No problem. Okay, liquid has a fluctuating theta. So this is how I'm measuring the local order in the liquid. It only really matters right as you approach the interface because that's the only place the action occurs.
Did you ever say what the coefficient function of phi was in front of the grad theta term?
The simulation
presumably should go to zero.
It should be a monotonically decreasing function. We're using phi squared right now.
So then why is there any meaning of theta in the liquid?
He added to this the idea that the theta fluctuates as a function of time. So there's a boundary region, right, when you're in near the interface, where phi is a half, where you've got the liquid going, I don't know which way I want to be, okay? And I'm going to show you what the consequences of that are in just a second. Okay, so we started to look at some materials, and this was just published, which we're calling the dizzy dendrite. Why do we call it that? Well, I mean, it's easy to model, you know, some growing polymer. It's just nicely analogous. It looks nice and square, and we can make sort of qualitative comparisons. For this is that was polymethyl methacrylate and polyethylene oxide mixture. And they threw into this material nucleating agents to get that growth center. You can actually see a little white dot there. And it sort of grows quite nicely. But the strange thing about this thing, of course, is it doesn't look like my old friend dendrites. And we were like, what the heck's going on in these systems? You know, we're growing quasi-crystals. I mean, it was very confusing for a while. But if you take a look carefully at the experiments, you'll see that as the dendrites grow, they sometimes run into these nucleating agents. And that causes the tip to deviate, we believe. Okay? So we've said, well, that's interesting. There are heterogeneities, essentially, in this system can create these crazy messed up patterns. And so we did some studies where we essentially put down pinning centers of certain sizes in this graph, orientation difference between the crystals, or the lateral displacement away from this tip. And you can see how we get that dendrite tip now to suddenly change direction. So the system is incorporating a grain boundary as it runs over this particle. Okay. And so here again are two experiments and a simulation now. And you can see that this is now a polycrystalline dendrite. So, I mean, this is exactly what's happening, is what you're asking about, as things orient into that structure. We'd rather put a grain boundary in.
Did they see that in the experiment, the polycrystalline?
Well, you'd have to do some kinds of scattering experiments on this. That has not yet been done, but I will show you some things which are very suggestive. Okay. And so Laszlo then, of course, played games where the orange ones are the experiments, and these are simulations. We can get things, again, that are very suggestive. But just that at this point. I mean, it's a very simple model to be recovering all of this. We also argued that you could use this possibly for microstructure control. In this case, what I did was we started playing with the pinning centers. In this case, we were rotating the pinning centers with some fixed frequency, and you can imagine that we create some crazy little structures of various kinds, lay them down in planes, things like that. Yeah, I was imagining that you could use some kind of external field would be the necessary way to do it. I talked to some experimentalists about possibly trying to do something like that. It's interesting. And so, you know, we're really getting to the point, I think, that at least within the field of crystal growth, that we can start to write down a fairly unified picture with a fairly small number of parameters. Okay, here's just an observation, though, and this gets into the last part of the talk, which is, if we reduce this mobility of theta, i.e. the speed with which the angles can twist, okay, something happens to this structure. Okay, and again, so you can see the liquid now, it's how it's fluctuating out there. These things start to grow like blobs with lots of little grains in them. Okay, which essentially saying is that the system would rather move that interface through that region with a grain boundary than wait to become a coherent crystal. And so we started to play with that, and essentially in this case we were varying the anisotropy up to ridiculous levels, but what you can see effectively is that you're getting effective heterogeneities, i.e. those dizzy dendrite patterns, without me actually putting in any pinning centers in anymore, i.e. the liquid is acting as an effective heterogeneity because it's so slow to readjust. So you've got a nice analogy between dynamic heterogeneity and pinning centers. All within this relatively straightforward model. And, you know, so then we looked at varying the number of pinning centers, changing this m theta parameter, and we get very analogous structures. And this is some experiments again. And you can look at that both in that space, and you can also look at it in angle space. Okay. Well, here's the last little bit of my talk. Okay, so spherolite. So I just did a web search on spherolites. Found all sorts of things. You get spherolites in polymer systems. One of the more technologically important ones is nodular cast iron, where they see these things all over the place. And selenium, this is Fev's groups. And these things are very suggestive of being polycrystals. Okay, as a matter of fact, and they know in this case that they're polycrystals. So this asks the question, how do you grow a sphere? Right? This seems like it should be a fairly straightforward structure to grow. And of course, when we did some of our first simulations, we got them and threw them away because they weren't dendrites. So how do you grow a sphere? Okay, whoops, one more click. All right. So then this actually relates to one of the talks this morning, which I thought was kind of interesting. Method one, diffusion-controlled growth. Okay, well, if you do that, you can grow a sphere, but it goes like root T. Okay, i.e., if diffusion is what's controlling the process, it's not really growing a steady-state sphere in that same structure. Okay, now to grow something that's sort of almost exactly a steady state, if you take Gibbs-Thompson and throw it away, and you get R that goes like T, well, what do you really need to do to get something to grow like a sphere? What you need to do is take diffusion out of the problem. Okay, and so if you look at the boundary condition for conservation of solute across a boundary, in this case right here, you'll see that what I really need is that either there be no jump in concentration across that boundary, or that the interface is effectively moving infinitely slowly. Okay. So I call, when delta C is zero, that's just called solute trapping. So we can have either real or effective trapping. Now, we used to see trapping all the time in these phase field simulations because we make our interface thickness too big to be realistic. And so all this material gets sucked right through the interface. And there's been a lot of work to remove this by Karma and others. But whether it's real or not is not as germane as the fact that there are other ways to get what I would call effective trapping, i.e., if you're willing to create another phase to get rid of that material, no problem. You can grow a polyphase structure, or, as I'll argue, you can grow a polycrystal. Why do you need to grow a polycrystal to grow something like a sphere? This is a polyphase structure here, so this is just a eutectic growing. So now you can grow spheres because you put one junk here. It's a local diffusion problem as opposed to a long-range diffusion problem. You can trap liquid. That's effectively trapping another phase. If you can grow a polycrystal, what can you do? You can grow spines. Okay? You can't do that in dendritic growth. Because if you had a dendrite, it has to respect that crystal symmetry goes much more slowly. But if you can grow spines, then you should be able to get a sphere. And this is a nice simulation that Laszlo did. And here you can see the crystal structure for that object. So you grow lots of branches now that can grow very tightly, and they can grow in this spherical shape. All right, we just did a bunch of parameter studies here. I don't want to get into too much of the detail. Because this is really, really fresh research. This is about, I don't know, a month old. So you'll have to forgive me. There's just a few slides here where we looked at various studies. This is effective supersaturation in the system. So this driving force is decreasing as you go this way. And as you increase the driving force, it grows more sphere-like. In this particular case, we had a reduced anisotropy and lowered this mobility. And so you get even more crazy grain structures, reduced mobility, high anisotropy. It starts to look spiky, like that simulation I showed you before. And again, we were playing with the mobility here. And you can see that if we get it down low enough, again, we get back to that ball that I showed you at the very beginning. So we went on a fairly long excursion where at first all we noticed was that we reduced m theta and we got this. And by the time we were done, we actually, I think, had learned a little bit about these systems that we just didn't know before and wouldn't have been possible without this model of grain boundaries. Okay. All right, so this is a summary. As I was talking about this morning or trying to suggest, symmetry is the only guide to creating this model. I mean, we didn't develop from a microscopic picture. And believe me, I spent 6 months in my office trying to integrate continuum models of dislocations to try to recover this model, and I have yet to succeed, although I invite anybody else to give it a try. And I guess I mentioned this somewhere. It would be nice to get a microscopic derivation. My guess is that this is obviously a very small approximation to the analytic structure of a grain boundary, this Magrad theta, and that's about as far as I'm willing to stick my neck out on the situation. But basically, we arrive at the conclusion that if theta is a meaningful order parameter, this is the only structure the theory could have if we're not going to have dislocations in it. Only two equations. We got this new idea for extending the idea of this angle into the liquid. 3D is non-trivial, but I think we'll have it probably in about 6 months, I hope. Let's see. Conserve dislocations, right. I have a feeling that that's, in fact, the proper way to approach the anti-rotation problem, and I have some promising results I'd be happy to talk about afterwards about how to get that. And I also like advertising this lower length scale model, which Ken Elder and Martin Grant have been promoting lately. I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, but it's just pretty neat. And it allows you to actually model atoms using a phase field model. It's kind of upside down when you first think about it, but I think it gives us a whole new length scale to link some of these models to, or a whole new approach to link some of these models to, and so I think it's pretty exciting. And just solving this, you get this kind of a thing. And that's all I have to say. I'm done. Thanks.
I have a question. Microphone.
Yeah.
But
In the old times, we looked for some principles that were discussed before, and one of the principles that we tried to put forward was the fact that there is a correlation between the rate of growth of the pattern and the pattern itself, and to show that there are morphology transitions, namely that from time to time, as you change the undercooling or other parameters, you see sharp transition or even jump. And I wonder, now that you have more detailed model, to what extent you can really observe it, or did you observe it?
Well, that's one question. I actually thought about putting that stuff in the talk. Obviously, there were reasons besides length not to. So the real reason is that it's not as crisp and clear as you'd like it to be. At least the number of axes we need to explore in parameter space to get a good microstructure map, if you will, right, is fairly large here. And so we were trying to find, at least we found this analogy between dynamic and static heterogeneity, so we could kill off one axis. But we're still working on exactly what we think that looks like. But we actually think we're able to, I don't have the picture, we can actually get things that look suspiciously DLA as well, now that we can incorporate in these misorientations. So it looks like we're able to get a good fraction of the structures.
Okay, the last pictures that you show when you mm-hmm. change the supersaturation, mm-hmm. it seemed like there is a transition from one type of growth to the most paralytic. So if mm-hmm. you change, for example, one parameter like this supersaturation and look at the velocity and the pattern, would you see a change, sharp change in the velocity as function of supersaturation at some value and will be change in the pattern?
Well, the reason that you see, the first order, the reason that you see the spherolytic jump, right, is trapping. Okay, so even if you have no misorientation in the problem, the question is there some kind of critical value where the trapping gets low enough that the diffusion field essentially, and the typical value that's quoted is that the interface thickness approaches the diffusion length.
Right.
Okay. And so, and we certainly see precise, that's precisely right, and we certainly see that. So in that sense, yes, I mean, that's...
Because it seems that above some supersaturation, it behaves, so effectively the supersaturation is 1.
That's right.
Or undercooling 1, and that's why solution for a sphere to be at constant velocity in the previous model,
right,
the simple model, is if you set delta to be 1.
That's right. I mean, and that's sort of, it was one of these classic things, you know, when I was back first year postdoc, and I get spheres and I throw them out. I thought there was some instability in the calculation or something like that, because suddenly it would go from a pretty dendrite to a sphere. But yeah, that's actually so well observed that nobody even probably comments
on it anymore. Now, the last question that I'd like to ask in this regard, do you see a change in the envelope of the pattern? If you look at the envelope, because mm-hmm. the models, again, that we did a long time ago, we associate the morphology transition with the transition in the envelope between being concave and convex.
I haven't studied that. I know Michel Rapat and his group have been interested in that because they want to use the phase field models to set up constitutive models to you in larger scale models. So, but yeah.
You? Any questions?
The first question I'd like to ask is basically about the spheroidal, you call it,
Spherolytic
shapes. So first of all, I want to understand if basically you claim that you called it the trapping condition. So is it equivalent to what other people would call reaction rate limited condition?
I mean, as I said,
so basically it's delimited by the reaction at the surface and not by the transport.
These are all reaction diffusion equations, right? So yeah. And the only question is, when am I taking diffusion out of the picture? And
okay.
So that would then be controlled.
So basically, your claim would be that in order to get spherolytic shapes, I mean, it must the condition must be that the dynamics must be reaction rate limited or trapped.
You just don't want to have to transport material over long distances.
Yeah.
Then you can't grow as a sphere. You'd rather grow like a radiator.
Okay.
Right. That's what a dendrite.
And can you classify, or has anybody tried, or maybe you tried to classify the most general spherolytic, it can go like, as you mentioned, there were several shapes, but...
I'm planning on doing it. Your thing seemed like about 1 month-old reasoning on my part.
I see.
So,
okay.
So I may get shot down before this week's over, so I'm kind of nervous, but...
I see. Okay. Okay, thanks.
Questions?
So what do you think the chances are for experiment, for you to compare with experiment? You know, quantitatively. Quantitatively.
Well, the smaller the system, the more likely we can get quantitative with these approaches.
So the there parameters, you have the parameters under control? And
No. I mean, well, Karma can talk to this extremely well. There are a bunch of length scales in this problem, and we're trying to simulate them all at once. Right. Okay. So the particular problem here is the interface thickness, mm-hmm. okay, which you would really prefer to simulate with at the tip radius size of a dendrite right. or right. one of these structures here. But unfortunately, for physical arguments, it has to be down at multiple angstroms, half a nanometer. Mm-hmm. So you need some way to compute with higher surface interface thickness and yet still get physical results. Right. And so the whole game has been to fix these models so that you can cheat and use a thick interface. And there has been progress made on that front, mm-hmm. But we're not doing that. We've been looking at sort of more top-down, how do you get the symmetry and how do you get the physics in.
And
so, that's sort of where my strengths lie. I think okay. I haven't been there, but I okay. more power than anyone who can do
okay.
it.
Okay.
I was just going to ask, why is it hard to extend your thing directly to 3D? Instead of a single angle, you'd have some type of frame that would have to...
No, that's right. It's trivial to say, right? Mm-hmm. I can say all I need is three Euler angles instead
yeah,
of
exactly.
one. That's all I need.
That's what I just said.
Okay, absolutely right. Okay, but first of all, mag grad what? Okay. And then secondly, the question is how to properly do the symmetries. Okay, if you really want to do crystals. So I have
a rotation tensor or whatever.
Well, you need to talk to the crystallographers. It's not just the rotation tensor, it's getting the possibility of all of these other symmetries. The real issue is this. If I have fourfold symmetry in 2D, it's S1 to start, it's S1 to finish. I can remap it, just like we were hearing about conformal mapping this morning. Okay, 3D, it's not true. Okay, if you reduce it by symmetry, it's a mess, and computing the gradient is complicated. So, I have a long note from my colleague Ryo Kobayashi about what we need to do to understand this, and we're just going to have to talk to the crystallographers. They've all figured this out before, but we don't understand it, and hopefully we'll eventually understand it. So that's the answer.
One last question.
One of the pictures that you showed, you introduce externally a twist, and you got a chiral, which is a chiral one. Chiral dendrite.
Right.
That
yeah.
has ended it. Now there are
that was
dendrites
my fault,
that
right,
go
my
like this when people introduce chiral molecules that have chirality.
Like liquid crystals or something.
No, they use phospholipids.
They really actually see
that. Yeah, and I wonder. It seems wonderful. That in your model you can now with the theta, it will be relatively easy
sure.
to introduce the intrinsic chirality into the model. That would be nice to try.
Well, okay, I'll write that down before I forget.
Any questions?